Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Our official enablers today include David Polson, Leanne Rayer, Christopher Welsh, and Deborah Gordon. They are voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show, and I am grateful. If you'd like to help and you're in a position to do that, go to my website. On the right-hand side of the homepage is a link that says you can help, and our voluntary subscriptions via PayPal start at $5 a month. On today's podcast, mercury in your dental fillings, we're going to talk with Charles Brown. A Muslim in the White House? We're going to hear some commentary from satirist and humorist Will Durst. And is there a tea party for me? Oh, we're going to find out. Use them well. Our intro music today from R.E.M. It's called World Leader Pretends. Let me make it good. I raise the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down. Well, there's a lot of talk about Tea Party candidates, about Tea Party ideas and Tea Party rallies. And the name really covers a lot of different ideas, different groups of people. And today we're going to talk to Daryl W. Perry, P-E-R-R-Y. He is the editor of Free Patriot Press, and he is one of the framers of resolutions passed this year by the Boston Tea Party. Daryl, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
It's nice to talk to you, and I'm glad you use your middle initial. That way I don't seem as arrogant and egotistical.
And it actually helps distinguish me from the Daryl Perry that is police chief of a town in Hawaii.
Oh, okay. Well, I had to adopt the middle initial because when I joined my union called AFTRA, there was already a guy named Peter Collins, a distinguished foreign correspondent. And so they said, kid, you got to do something different. So I use my middle initial, and I'm always happy when other people do, too. Daryl, first up, those of us who aren't familiar with the various elements that use the name Tea Party often get a little confused. And the Boston Tea Party National Committee, which you chair, is different, is it not, from the Tea Party movements that have popped up around the country that I link to phony grassroots organizations funded by the Koch family through Americans for Prosperity and initiated and promoted by Dick Armey and his Freedom Works organization. Do you separate yourself from those alleged grassroots organizations?
We are in no way affiliated with any of those groups using the Tea Party name. And the way they came up with Tea Party was taxed enough already. They're, oh, well, that spells tea if you take the first letter of each one of those words. So we'll say we're a Tea Party. The Boston Tea Party predates those groups by at least 3 years. The BTP was founded in 2006 as an offshoot of the Libertarian Party, by a group of people that thought that the Libertarian Party was not libertarian enough anymore. They saw what they called the Republicanization of the Libertarian Party.
Mm-hmm.
to where, you know, they changed the platform in 06 to take away a lot of the more minimalistic government planks and adopted some planks that, while they don't necessarily say we want big government in this area, it does leave it open for that interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what is your reaction to these groups that, you know, they're offended by the term teabagger, but they use the idea of sending tea bags to Washington as a symbol of their protest. And this, in my view, is a group of people who pose as angry, and maybe they've gotten angrier over the last year or so, but when this first popped up in the summer of 2009, I found them to be a bunch of posers. And when I look at Americans for Prosperity in particular, the money that's being laundered through there by the Koch brothers to promote their hard right agenda, and it's a corporate agenda. It's not a libertarian agenda. And they are attempting to co-opt elements of the principles that you and I are going to discuss today and that you in the Boston Tea Party stand for.
It's one of those things. When I first heard about the groups, I was thinking, okay, now I'll give them a chance. Maybe they are legitimately upset about, you know, the increased spending by the government. Some of the groups actually, they didn't use the name Tea Party, but there were groups that formed during the 2008 presidential election. A lot of Ron Paul supporters that supported small government held rallies around the country at different times, and they had an In the Fed rally to abolish the Federal Reserve in 2008, on November 22nd of 2008, which November 22nd is actually the anniversary date of when the original group got together on Jekyll Island and came up with the idea for what became the Federal Reserve, which is, you know, this group of private bankers that now have a government-issued monopoly to create money.
Mm-hmm.
So I heard about these groups. Okay, maybe they're coming around to our side of seeing things. And I was living in Birmingham, Alabama at the time. I heard about who was funding the quote-unquote Tea Party on April 15th. It was the Republican committee of one of the neighboring counties.
Mm-hmm.
That struck me as weird right off the bat, because I was like, wait a second, if it's the Republican committee that's funding this thing, maybe they're not coming around to us. Maybe they're just mad because it's not their guy doing all the spending now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, I'm sure you know, as well as a lot of other people, when George Bush was president, he increased non-military spending by the largest amount ever.
Yes, he did. And he rolled up huge deficits with massive tax cuts, borrowing to spend for unnecessary wars, and it has created the mess that we are living through today. But Darrell, let me ask you about this, because I believe that John McCain was so desperate that when he and his advisors selected Sarah Palin as his vice presidential candidate, it would have been 2 years ago, right about now, as we're speaking on the last day of August. I believe that he unleashed forces that even surprised him, particularly, my dogs are barking, particularly when he had to dance to the bullets that were being fired at his feet by J.D. Hayworth. He dispatched him in this recent primary, but he certainly had to really change into a John McCain that almost nobody recognizes.
And I hate to say move to the right, because that just perpetuates the whole false left-right paradigm that people think exists. But he definitely became more Republican. Because if you recall, when he ran against George Bush in the 2000 primaries for president, he was, you know, this I'm the anti-Republican Republican. And he was totally not the party guy. That was his thing.
Right. Maverick.
I'm the outsider that's in the party but I'm not a party guy. Mm-hmm. I'm an independent Republican. And then over the course of his presidential campaign, he became the party guy, and you saw him and George Bush hanging out all the time, but 8 years previous, they absolutely hated each other.
Right.
Or at least in front of the cameras.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the quote from Jesse Ventura. He said, politics and pro wrestling are the same. In front of the camera, the two sides play as though they hate one another. But when the cameras are off and they're behind closed doors, they're having beers together.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's a club and we're not members, that's for sure. But what about what I was referring to, that in selecting Sarah Palin, he really unleashed these forces that almost killed him and have run roughshod over the Obama administration with a big push from the Fox News channel?
I'm not really sure. You know, I'm not really sure that just by selecting Sarah Palin that necessarily meant that Fox was going to wind up supporting her and being anti-Obama. Because Fox's whole gig was, you know, supposedly we're fair and balanced, but we're going to tell you the Republican side of every story. So, yeah, maybe not. I'm not really sure.
All right.
I just think Fox has been more advantageous because, oh, look, we've got this, you know, what most people are considering to be a fairly attractive, somewhat intelligent woman that we're throwing in front of TV cameras. And, you know, I don't necessarily buy the whole thing about her being a very intelligent woman. Just like I don't think George Bush was intelligent, I doubt a lot of the intelligence of most people that are portrayed as being, you know, the intelligent minds of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Fox is being very advantageous of the groups that, like you said, Dick Armey is putting out. They're being funded by these groups that have a corporatist agenda. And they're claiming to, you know, speak out against small government and lower taxes and less spending. But none of these, well, I won't say none, 99% of the people that are attending these rallies had zero problem with the big government spending of the Republicans that were in office for 8 years before Obama took over.
Amen.
Glenn Beck, who just held a rally a couple days ago at the Lincoln Memorial, he's being portrayed as, you know, this great libertarian mind and the new, you know, Rush Limbaugh, or whoever they're saying that he's, you know, taking over for. But he supported the banker bailout. He supported the Patriot Act. Neither one of those are libertarian philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
But he's being portrayed by some of the media as being this libertarian ideologue. He's not a libertarian at all. He's giving real libertarians a bad name.
Well, he's a poser and an opportunist who doesn't really have much of a core set of values or history. And he really is the kind of guy who will say almost anything if he thinks that it'll get the rating meter to tick up a notch.
And this is the same guy that I remember several years ago described himself as a rodeo clown recovering alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, he wants everybody to take him serious, and he'll spell off all these things that sound good on the surface until you start to actually pay attention three sentences in and then listen to what he said 2 years ago.
Well, Daryl,
that's the thing. Most people have such a short-term memory, they're not going to go back to see what somebody used to say.
Oh, yeah.
Or and they'll make excuses. Well, people change.
And even with the Internet and all the links that you can go to archives and find out information and see what Glenn Beck said 5 years ago, most people don't bother. Whatever's presented on the flat screen in front of them is what they consider to be the reality of the moment, and they all too often take it in without appropriate skepticism. Daryl, I want to turn to the reason why I invited you on today. I received an email which included a column that you wrote and published back in early July, and it tipped me off to some common opinions and positions that I have with you. And I put it in real simple term, and since we're podcasting and the FCC can't censor my language, I like to be very clear. And one of the things that I tell politicians, sometimes I sanitize it for them, but I want my goddamn Fourth Amendment back. And it really irritates me. To me, this is the most important issue of the last 8 years, to have seen the way the Bush administration created a near police state in this country with the Patriot Act, with the illegal wiretapping. And now this has been papered over, extended, and affirmed by Democrats up to and including President Obama, who disappointed me greatly in August of 2008 when he violated a campaign pledge and voted for the phony FISA reforms. And you published a piece that gave me new information that Homeland Security now has backscatter scanners, and that these can be placed on trucks. They could drive down my block and see what's in the trunk of my car, whether it's a case of oranges, a case of marijuana, or a case of ammunition. And I am a real fundamentalist when it comes to the Fourth Amendment. It's very clear, it's unambiguous, that you cannot violate the private property rights or privacy of an individual without probable cause and a specific court order. And it has really bugged me because the Tea Party posers who get so much attention in the media these days never address these issues. They're only promoting a low-tax, no-choice, and I'm talking about abortion rights, agenda that, as you pointed out, is linked to the Republican Party, not to the values of our founders, and certainly not to what you would define as libertarian values in today's context.
Yeah, and what's really scary about this, not only can they put that little scanner in the back of a van, drive down the street and see what's in your car, they can see what's in your house. They can see through anything that is not basically a steel wall.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way the x-rays work. If they see a solid block, like let's just say that you do put a steel wall in front of your house, they would see that big solid block of steel, then they could probably say, we have probable cause, and then go get a warrant.
Yeah.
From a totally impartial or non-impartial judge, because the judges work for the government, and of course the judges are just going to go along with it. Oh, well, yeah, okay, we'll go ahead and give you the warrant. Where there is no probable cause at all, other than our van could not see through your front door or couldn't see past your wall, or couldn't see into the track of your car. And what's really scary, aside from the vans, is the fact that so many federal agencies are claiming that they're exempt from the Constitution.
Yeah.
The Customs, Department of Customs, claims to be exempt from the Constitution, claims to be able to search anybody for any reason coming across the border or at a offshore checkpoint. And I know this firsthand because I went on a cruise back in the spring, traveled by myself, which apparently is suspicious. I'm coming through customs. They pull me off to the side into this separate room, and he says he needs to go through my bag. I asked him why. Said it's a secondary screening, and I told him, you know, I've got constitutional rights against unreasonable searches and seizures.
And Daryl,
does not apply to us.
Daryl, just clarify here. This was when you returned from a cruise. This wasn't outbound as you were trying to board a plane at an airport.
No, this was inbound, coming through customs.
Uh huh.
In Miami, Florida.
Okay.
Just got off the ship. 10 minutes prior,
mm-hmm.
Walked through, you know, a few hallways, go stand in line to declare I didn't buy anything. pulls me over, says, we're exempt from the Constitution, and besides, nothing I do can be considered to be unreasonable. He saw in my jacket pocket a copy of the Constitution. I have a luggage tag with the Fourth Amendment, and I happen to have had a DVD in my bag that is of the movie Camp FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
He said, oh, you must be some kind of Constitution nut or something. I just said, yeah, something like that. So he tells me to put my things back in my bag. As I'm doing that, I realize he's gone with my passport. He went over to the next room over where they had a system of computers, swiped my passport through their system, and I have no clue if he added anything into my record or not.
He's a Constitution.
What they're saying about me, what's on file.
Right. They probably put a note in there. He's a constitutional nut with a bad attitude.
Yeah. And I tried finding out, went to the Department of State website to find out about a Freedom of Information request to find out what was added to my record. And they're very vague as far as whether they will actually answer a request or not. It says you have the right to make the request, but we will not create a report just to answer your request.
Mm-hmm.
So unless what's in my file has been put in report form, they don't have to send it to me. That's scary.
It really is.
And then when you think of all of the fusion centers that are opening up across the country to where local law enforcement, within a matter of seconds, can check the FBI, the CIA, Homeland Security, or any other database to pull up whatever information they keep on you. And when you add that to all the reports that are coming out, where they're saying that people that support Fourth Amendment rights or people that support Second Amendment rights or people that talk about the Constitution are quote-unquote potential terrorists. If you have certain bumper stickers on your car, the police should be wary of you. That's very scary.
Well, Daryl, I want to take a few minutes here and go through the program of the Boston Tea Party that was adopted at your convention May 27 of this year, 2010. And it's a single page with 5 points. And as I read this, I was struck by how much agreement there is with me on, I guess I'm on the far left. I don't know. I never thought I was that far left. But the left has moved so far to the center that I'm kind of out there on a limb. But let's go through these 5 points and chat a little bit about some of them and where we agree and disagree. Number one, end the wars of aggression. The U.S. should withdraw all forces, you say, from Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, South Korea, Germany, Japan, and all other occupied nations. Now, as I referenced, we're speaking here just an hour or so before President Obama is going to declare that his withdrawal of all but 50,000 troops from Iraq is A, the honoring of a campaign promise, and B, that we're supposed to just all relax and say, well, isn't that great? But we have 50,000 troops that stay there, an unknown number of armed contractors, and an unknown number of support staff who are contractors who may not carry arms or act as mercenaries, but who are still part of a residual U.S. force there. And so you and I are in total agreement here. I don't know that I need to see all the troops out of Germany or Japan. I think some of the deployments on the bases of friendly nations are probably in our national interest. But fundamentally, I agree with you that we certainly shouldn't be in Iraq and Afghanistan. We shouldn't be fighting an undeclared illegal war in Pakistan or the new one in Yemen.
And why do we have troops in 158 countries and territories around the world?
And almost 900 bases in offshore of the United States. many of which...
I think the total number of troops I saw was somewhere close to 400,000 troops around the world, spread out over nearly 900 bases in 159 countries or territories.
Mm-hmm.
We have 57,000 troops still in Germany. World War II ended in 1945. We still have 27,000 troops in South Korea. I think it's 20,000 troops in Japan.
Mm-hmm. And they don't want us there. I mean, we've been causing problems in Okinawa for decades now, and it's very uncomfortable for the Japanese government to continue to allow the U.S. to lease those bases and keep American troops there. So, so
we've got troops in almost every Central American and South American country.
That's right.
We're building an empire. Well, we've been building an empire for 100 years. Now we're protecting the empire.
And it's a corporate empire, primarily, that we're protecting. It's not the interests of the American people, or even what could be defined as the national interests based on an honest and transparent foreign policy.
I would say that the majority of the reason that we have troops all over the world is to enforce the drug war. Because if we can control the opium fields in Afghanistan, our government can control how much opium gets brought in to the U.S., and then they arrest people for using opium. We've got an illegal war in Mexico. Most people don't even pay attention to that. We've got the DEA fighting a war in Mexico to enforce an illegal drug war.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we want to, you know, we're just playing world's police force, and if we're not all over the world, then people might kill each other.
Then for continuity...
Well, people are killing each other now because we're involved in everybody's petty little disagreement.
And so let me jump to item number three on your the issues that you adopted in your program of the Boston Tea Party. End the war on drugs. The federal government should repeal all laws against the use and trade of, quote, controlled substances. The states and local communities should also permit people to freely choose what substances they wish to consume without government intervention. Now, I agree with you about 90%. I do believe that prohibition does not work and that it creates more problems than it solves. There are, however, some drugs that I consider too dangerous, crystal meth and heroin, to allow them to, you know, just be sold over the counter. I do want to see a kind of deprohibition that basically allows people to fuck themselves up if they want to, as long as we can be sure that they're not hurting other people. And so with that little bit of a proviso, I agree with the fundamental idea that the war on drugs has failed and that it is at the basis of a lot of our military and foreign policy blunders.
Drugs were all decriminalized, they would be safer, because then you would take away the need for people to make the crystal meth labs out of a trailer that are very dangerous.
Correct.
People could actually go into business legitimately, find safe ways to make the drugs that then do not, one, they don't cause as much potential harm to the person making the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Because how many times do you hear about the crystal meth trailers blowing up and people dying? So it's a safer way to actually make the drugs, because people wouldn't have to go around hiding it. And then two, it would actually make, and this might sound weird to say, a safer drug, but because it's being manufactured potentially in more of, you know, a factory-type place as opposed to the basement of somebody's house, it's a cleaner environment, so you don't run as much risk of contaminants getting in there that wind up causing more potential damage.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not advocating anybody using crystal meth. I'm not advocating anybody use heroin. But if they want to do so, as long as they don't harm me or harm another person, they should be free to do so.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I would say that most drugs should be treated similar to alcohol, to where if you commit a crime and it's found illegal or, you know, now legal substances, you know, if you commit a crime and you've got alcohol in your system, then you can be charged with another crime.
Mm-hmm.
Would be the same thing. You know, I'm not advocating anybody smoke marijuana and then drive down the street.
Right.
But if you happen to do so, and then you crash into somebody, then, yes, certainly you should be able to be charged for violating a law.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to sit in your couch and smoke some marijuana and then eat 10 bags of Cheetos, you're not harming me by doing that.
Right.
You should not go to jail.
Okay.
I read recently where the Netherlands, who has very, quote-unquote, liberal drug policies, almost everything is legal, they are actually having to close their prisons because they don't have enough prisoners.
Well, I'd love to see us develop that problem here.
People that have a medical problem.
Daryl, let me jump to item number two here. End the Fed. The U.S. Congress should audit the Fed. I fully support that. Allow for competition of currencies. I'm in favor of that. Repeal the income tax. I'm not so sure. Abolish the IRS. Nice idea. I don't think it'll ever happen. Refuse any further bailouts of corporations in any industry. I'm 100% in agreement with you there. So let's just pause on those issues, because I'm not unalterably opposed to repealing the income tax, but I do believe that we need some government. I don't agree with the extreme libertarian posture that, you know, we should just shrink government until it's almost invisible. But I do think that we have to have some way of raising revenue, and that the income tax is the most fair slash progressive way to do that. And therefore, I don't think we can abolish the IRS. But I am sympathetic to the attitude, I'll put it that way.
47% of wage earners pay no income tax. A large percentage of that actually get increased, you know, they get more money back from the IRS than what they had withheld from, you know, employer withholding.
That's the earned income tax credit. Uh-huh.
Due to earned income credits and the like.
Yeah.
So you have 53% of wage earners that file with the IRS are the ones actually paying into a system.
Mm-hmm.
If you abolished the IRS and then got rid of all unconstitutional spending, that would be the spending that falls outside of the list of specific items in Article 1, Section 8 that the U.S. federal government has the express authority to do. Get rid of all unconstitutional spending, and you abolish the IRS, you have a balanced budget. The federal government gets enough money from excise taxes and import tariffs to operate on a constitutional basis.
Okay, I think you make a good case there, and like I say, I'm sympathetic to it. I don't see it in my lifetime. The paragraph here continues, furthermore, all federal regulations covering every aspect of the private economy, including those individuals who seek self-employment, should be repealed across the board. Well, this one is too much for me, frankly, Daryl, because I think that there are a lot of important workplace safety regulations, there are interstate commerce rules, and so I find that people who want to roll back regulations, and I'm not trying to lump you into this category, but all too often are corporatists who simply want to expand their ability to make profits while reducing their responsibility to operate a business in a safe and ethical manner. And so I do see the need for regulation. Again, I am sympathetic to the idea of rolling back unnecessary regulation, but typically I can't agree with most other people on what fits the definition of unnecessary.
I am the complete opposite of a corporatist. I think that corporate personhood is one of the worst things that ever happened. When the Supreme Court in the 1880s ruled that corporations are people,
Santa Fe,
one of the worst things that ever happened.
It was the Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County, yes.
So what I would like to see is get rid of corporations to where every business is either a partnership or sole proprietorship. That way someone can be held responsible. Because one of the benefits of corporation, or what they say the benefits of corporation, is it limits your liability. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, make sure nobody gets held responsible when your Deep Sea Horizon rig explodes and 11 people die.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure nobody gets held responsible when your, what was it with the Toyotas? The
accelerator stuck.
Yeah, the accelerator gets stuck. A whole bunch of people wind up having an accident. Nobody's held responsible for that. So corporate personhood is one of the worst things ever.
Now, hold on. Daryl, wait a minute, because I fully agree with you that corporate personhood is a bad concept, and it makes a lot of bad law. But coming back to your earlier point under number two, that any further bailouts of corporations in any industry would be banned, that's where I think that the corporate model works. It was the intervention to bail out Detroit, to bail out the banks, that was wrong, and it violated the fundamentals of the corporate system. But I believe in limiting liability because I think that it does enable people to take greater risks with other people's money. And number two, I believe in a different model of corporate governance where we actually enforce the fiduciary obligation of a director to serve the interests first of the shareholder and not the management. And we have seen that that's been turned on its ear in the last 30, maybe 40 years, where corporate boards are there to serve the interests of top management and to shower them with too much compensation and stock options that are backdated illegally that they don't deserve. And so my argument is that the corporate model, if it's properly implemented, I think is actually pretty brilliant. And if we stop intervening to prop up corporations, to subsidize ethanol or, you know, other things that really just are benefits to big corporate interests, then I think that we wouldn't need to abolish them. We wouldn't need to limit business ownership to sole proprietors or partners.
I'm sure it could possibly work, but, you know, in my lifetime, and I'm, you know, only 32 years old, so in my lifetime, the corporate model has been, let's give the CEO a $50 million golden parachute for bankrupting the company, and then he gets to walk away with millions of dollars. So I've not seen the corporate method actually work to benefit, you know, society as a whole,
mm-hmm.
or even, you know, benefit the stockholders or benefit the consumer. It's always been to benefit management.
Well, you're right about that. And just one other example is that when I was, I'm a little older than you, I'm 57. And when I was growing up, most companies that you could afford to buy a share of stock in paid dividends every quarter. There was a return to shareholders. And so there was the immediate value of getting a check from the company that you own stock in every quarter. And then there was the long-term benefit of holding those shares as they increased in value. And
right.
That all shifted when we went to this quarter-by-quarter mentality, when companies were permitted to stop paying dividends. And so it becomes much more of a wager where you buy a stock hoping that it's going to zoom up in value and you can sell it before it crashes and pocket the difference. And that, in my view, creates the wrong incentives for management to play games, to cheat, lie, and steal, to do round-trip deals or to ship a bunch of product around the block at the end of the quarter to jack up the numbers. And all of that phony kind of business gimmickry could be brought under control with appropriate regulation, with the appropriate governance by the board of directors, and we've got to let them fail. When a company reaches bankruptcy, they should go under, they should be broken up, and we shouldn't be propping them up or using any other extraordinary means to keep a bad business going. It just doesn't make any sense.
I completely agree with you. Let me go back to something about the regulations.
Go ahead.
I never did get to address that. I'm not saying that there should be no regulations. I don't think that the government should necessarily be the ones forcing the regulations, because the way they make the regulations is based on lobbyists giving them money or political committees giving them money, and then they grandfather in certain businesses. So the majority of the regulations that are in place are only to hinder new businesses. If you had non-governmental agencies that were voluntary organizations that people joined voluntarily, and then they were able to police themselves, not so much me police my own business, but let's just say that I'm in a joint venture and me and you and 15 other companies decide we're going to create this agency to oversee us, and these are the rules that we agree to. The other businesses in that non-governmental agency would be the ones to go inspect you. You and the other 14 businesses would come inspect me. So everybody's keeping everybody honest.
The only problem with your model is that in banking or coal mining or anything else, we don't have 14 competitors anymore. They're only a handful. And
due to most of the regulations that are put in place and the corporate model to where U.S. Steel can go buy all the competing steel companies.
But I would argue that's a product of deregulation.
We've got two big giant mega farms that control, what is it, 80% of food distribution?
Well, at least in
that,
eggs.
That, to me, is a problem.
Yeah?
Yeah, and that's not a problem from a lack of regulation. That's a problem due to regulation that hinders new competitors. If you decide you want to grow wheat in your backyard, you are violating interstate commerce law, not because you're necessarily selling the wheat to anybody, but by you not purchasing somebody else's wheat. The Supreme Court has ruled that that violates interstate commerce.
Well, Darrell, in the interest of time, I'll just say that I think you make a provocative argument, and that I would like to see, and this we probably do agree 100% on, a new round of trust busting like we saw at the beginning of the 20th century. And we really need to break up these big corporations. And if we did that, some of the models that you're proposing would intrigue me. Because, again, if we had real competition in the banking sector, if we had real competition in broadcasting, you know, we would see things operate very differently, and the kind of industry-based regulation that you describe might be viable. And I don't, you know, I don't prefer government to other forms of regulation. But when I can't trust an industry to police itself, like, say, the banking industry, which Paulson and Bush and those guys promoted big time, and Bernanke and Geithner, who are still part of the mess, then, you know, we can't really apply these kind of ideal approaches to a corrupted system. And so I think you and I would probably agree that we need to clean house.
It's one of those things that, how do we get there from here?
Right. So, Darrell, I'm running out of time here, but I want to just mention two other key points in the program of the Boston Tea Party, and people can go to bostontea.us and read this for yourselves, and I'll put the link in the show file at peterbcollins.com. But number four is one, I think I agree with almost every word here. End the abuses of liberty. Congress should repeal the Patriot Act, Military Commissions Act, the FISA Act, abolish the NSA, the TSA, the CIA, and any other federal agency that infringes on individual rights. Congress should review and revoke the emergency powers granted to the president in response to the September 11th attacks. The U.S. should restore privacy by forbidding warrantless wiretapping of phone and internet communication. The U.S. must restore habeas corpus, allowing all detainees, foreign and domestic, a speedy and public trial. No physical or environmental discomfort, read torture, should be used to influence the interrogation of suspects for any crime. The U.S. government must respect the rights of all people, regardless of place of birth, status of citizenship, or suspicion of criminality. That really sings for me, Daryl, I just have to tell you. And then number five, end the immigration fiasco. And this is a surprising difference between you, the Boston Tea Party, and these new formed so-called Tea Party individuals around, because most of them are kind of taking a hardline nativist position and a very anti-immigration position, and also support of the stop and show me your papers law in Arizona. But your resolution here basically calls for opening our borders, and you say we should loosen restrictions on citizens and visitors alike, allowing people of many backgrounds and cultures to coexist in a society of social and economic freedom and prosperity. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol agencies at all levels should be abolished and dismantled immediately. Well, I think that you present a lot of interesting ideas, Daryl, and I really enjoyed talking with you today. I'd like to do it again because I've noted that you're planning to run for president, not in the next cycle, but in 2016. So yes. I think you offer us a lot of good food for thought, and I applaud your activism. Even though we don't agree 100% on every issue, when I hear somebody like you who is really committed to our Constitution and committed to your vision of what America should be like, and because you're working in what I think is an appropriate and systematic way to achieve your goals, all I can say is it's great to know you.
Thank you very much, Peter, and I would love to be back on your show anytime.
All right, I'll be calling you. That's Daryl W. Perry here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thank you, Daryl.
Thanks, Peter.
It's great to talk with you.
Send me a link to the show whenever you get it posted.
It'll be going up sometime tomorrow, and I will do that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time today. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bonjour, this is Veronique Raskin. I am the CEO of the Organic Wine Company, and I want to personally invite you to join the Peter B. Monthly Organic Wine Club. Call me for the details, and I do answer my phone, at 1-888-ECO-WINE, or visit us at www.theorganicwinecompany.com. À bientôt, j'espère. Merci.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, and we invite you to spread the word to like-minded individuals. In fact, you're at your computer, right? So why don't you email 10 friends right now and send them over to peterbcollins.com. Now, everybody, can I have a big smile, huh? That's Smash Mouth's version of the old war tune. Joining us now is Charles G. Brown. He is National Counsel of Consumers for Dental Choice and wants to alert you to some issues related to the fillings that the dentist wants to put into your mouth. Charlie Brown, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Peter, good to be on your show out there in the Bay Area. Great.
Well, nice to talk with you, and we were comparing notes. We're both formerly from Ohio. I grew up in Cincinnati in the southern part of the state. And you have a somewhat famous brother, at least in progressive political circles, Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio.
My little brother is Sherrod, that's right.
He's your little brother. Well, he speaks for me very often, and I really appreciate that he took on the mantle of Paul Wellstone in the Senate as a real activist guy And he's got that unique, gruff voice. And every time I've talked to him, I've come away just with that imprinted.
All right. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
But you talk a little differently. You're not down there, Rob.
Absolutely. I don't have to talk as much since I'm not in the Senate, right?
Now, tell us a little bit about the issues, because I got some information from your organization, and really this is the first time that I was alerted to the high concentrations of mercury that are found in many dental fillings, particularly the cheaper kind of dental fillings that are called amalgam. And I'm a lucky guy. I do have some fillings in here, but I think it's three years ago, the last time I actually had a filling from my childhood replaced, so it wasn't a new cavity. But tell us a little bit about what the options are when you're in the dental chair and how we can avoid getting mercury embedded into our teeth for, what, the rest of our lives?
Sure. The silver fillings just aren't silver. It's a deception by the American Dental Association and the amalgam manufacturers. These so-called silver fillings are 50% mercury. They have some silver, but they have twice as much mercury as silver. They have as much mercury as a thermometer. That's how much mercury is going into the mouth. The other fillings do not have mercury. The white-colored ones, which are the resin or composite, are mercury-free. So are the the porcelain, the gold, those are not. But the amalgam filling is mainly mercury, and the American Dental Association even has a gag rule instructing dentists not to talk about the mercury. Now, we've been able, through the First Amendment and through our citizen movement and the consumer group I run, to effectively to bust that gag rule, but dentists who still use amalgam do not offer that it's mercury. I mean, imagine a pregnant woman being told, man, here come your mercury fillings. I mean, she'd have her butt out of the chair and out of the room right then. Instead, you know, she's been told, oh, these are silver fillings. And, oh, thank you, doctor, for being so nice. It's not nice.
Well, Charlie, help me out a little bit here, because one of the things that has occurred in recent months is that a special court was convened to take a look at the arguments that were brought forward by many parents of autistic children that mercury contained as a stabilizer vaccinations, was thought to be a cause of autism. And the court evaluated the evidence and ruled very firmly, denying declining to embrace the argument that mercury in vaccinations is linked to autism. But what you're describing here doesn't seem to be to have been covered by that investigation. And what do you know, or what can you tell us about the science of mercury embedded in dental fillings and what kind of complications it can cause for that human being or perhaps her children?
Yes, and her children. I'm glad you added that, Peter. What amalgam causes is mercury toxicity. It puts mercury into the body. The Environmental Protection Agency, every scientist in the world, anybody who looks at it realizes how toxic mercury is. It is a virulent neurotoxin. Advocates in our movement have lost their babies because they went to the dentist. And the dentist didn't even tell them he was putting in mercury, and they lost their babies, pregnant women. Mercury is a neurotoxin. The idea that you could implant half a gram of mercury, or several grams of it if it's several fillings, an inch from the brain. Remember, mercury is not just the most toxic heavy metal; it is the most vaporous, because it as you look at it, you see how shimmery it is. I mean, it's the only metal that's liquid at room temperature. It's heavily, mm-hmm. It's very quite vaporous. So the fumes are coming off. They go to the brain first. So amalgam is a neurotoxin and a reproductive toxin. Proposition 65 there in California says it is. There's a warning posted on dentist walls that they have 10 or more employees. Most of them don't have 10 or more employees. So again, the ones that don't use amalgam, and that's half of them. Half of them have gotten out of this using this primitive material. The other half continue to use it. This is a Civil War product. This is a primitive product where the dentist actually carves out good tooth matter in order to create the bowl to put in the mercury, which causes tooth problems later. It has no place in modern medicine or modern dentistry whatsoever. Any dentist who's reasonable knows that. Unfortunately, the profiteers, as in every industry, are there, and half the dentists view this as such an easy profit picture. They can make more per chair per day with mercury. So proliferating in these dental factories in Oakland and all through rural areas and in urban areas, the Indian Health Service, the Army, the prisons, it's mercury for people that are that the elite look down on in this country.
And Charlie, you know, I really like my dentist, and I've had three or four over my lifetime. They've all been really good practitioners, very much dedicated to my health, and they're very good at giving me information about, hey, this is what I'm going to do next. I'm going to drill a big hole in your tooth, and then I'm going to fill it. But I've never had any discussion about fillings, except to say that the amalgam fillings that my John Birch dentist in Cincinnati installed when I was a kid have started to fail. And they're replacing those. But nobody's ever said, what kind of filling do you want? And here are the choices, and here's what we recommend.
Well, and so your dentist is not telling you information.
Yeah.
The American Dental Association has a gag rule and tells dentists don't talk about the mercury. And the way to make the fast money is not to do it. I hear over and over people say, I like my dentist, as if to say that somehow this medical complex that's administering far too many drugs and far too many toxins like mercury, as long as we like the people doing it, there's no problem. Well, I'm sure a lot of the Wall Street people were really nice guys and good guys to go to a barbecue with, but they stole the country blind. And dentists that are still using mercury are making a horrible mistake and should know better by now. If they read independent journals instead of used the American Dental Association propaganda, they wouldn't do it. Countries all over the world are stopping the use of amalgam. Sweden stopped it altogether. Unfortunately, our FDA is totally in the pocket of industry. Our FDA commissioner came directly from the largest seller of amalgam. She was a director on the board of Henry Schein, Inc., the largest seller of amalgam, went straight to FDA, promised the Obama administration she would not participate, Margaret Hamburg, in any matter affecting Schein as long as she owns stock options. She broke the promise. She participated in the Henry Schein rule. And 48 hours later, after it was announced, the general counsel of Schein wrote a note to her on her personal email, a private email address, we are indebted to you for your work as commissioner. I mean, this is our Food and Drug Administration. It's not any better than it was. And the bureaucracy is run by dentists, and the people at the top have no interest in protecting the public, at least when it comes to the mercury and amalgam.
Now, this is stunning because Senator Obama had a pretty strong record being aware of the dangers of mercury and writing some legislation to try to limit exports and some other factors. So why would he appoint a pro-mercury individual like this woman Hamburg to the FDA?
Well, let's look back at the president's record, because it is outstanding. And he wrote the law that banned the export of mercury. He reversed over and over. He's come through here on the mercury issues. He reversed the Bush administration in his first month in office and directed that the U.S. participate in a worldwide mercury treaty that we're very active in. All forms of mercury. Bush didn't want a treaty, not surprisingly. The president did, President Obama. He said, let's go. I was told at the first UN session on this treaty, the first negotiating session, that they wouldn't even been there if it weren't for Barack Obama, because he got it started. And when the U.S. was sitting out, it wasn't moving forward. When the U.S. got in, it moved forward. His record's gated. He's got a great EPA commissioner, Lisa Jackson. She took on the dentist in New Jersey, where she was the state director. Obviously, the Hamburg appointment is a mistake. I mean, when somebody signs an agreement, when she comes to FDA saying, I will not participate in any matter affecting Henry Schein as long as I own their stock or stock options, I mean, how can a president possibly oversee somebody when she breaks the agreement? It isn't they can't micromanage their departments. There's a presumed good faith. And this is one that's she's a corporate liberal. Her husband is a hedge fund trader, the kind of guys that make $1 billion a year and don't pay taxes, you know, right? So he's trading in the very stock that she's regulating. It was not a good appointment, but she exasperated it by breaking her word and proceeding and digging in and convening a meeting immediately on the amalgam rule. And she had two letters from me by then saying, "You should not. I'm head of the consumer group. What are your intentions with regard to this rule? We're very concerned that you were on the board of Henry Schein and made $1 million from him, well over that. And please clarify." And instead, she maybe it's because I wrote her. I don't know. She went in and participated.
Hmm.
Well, I don't blame the president, because the president appointed good people, and a lot of places you can't appoint everybody good. He set the direction. We have a treaty going, but I mean, Hamburg should not be at FDA. She mm-hmm. should not be there. She should be removed. And we should get somebody in there who's not so tied to corporate America, but through both her husband and her own corporate ties with the dental industry.
Now, Charlie, this is the first I've heard of this. Do we need to really get some media attention to the FDA on this mercury issue?
Well, I hope you would. I mean, FDA is going to have a hearing, Peter, in the middle of December, December 14th and 15th. They've reopened the amalgam issue. We've raised enough cane out here. And as the FDA press, you know, the specialized press that covers agencies, every agency's got that kind of press that mm-hmm. covers them. They've covered this battle heavily, and FDA finally decided, okay, we'll revisit what we've done. So in mid-December, there's going to be hearings, and I hope the press is all over them like peanut butter on jelly, saying, why are you unlike the rest of the world? Why do you at FDA allow amalgam to be sold without even telling the parents that this material is mainly mercury? You could at least require labeling, if nothing else, instead of saying to the American Dental Association, we don't care if you cover it up, fine with us. I mean, mm-hmm. it's scandalous what FDA is doing, but... you know, they're pretty good with their public relations. That's the one thing FDA is good at, and people tend to think they're protecting the public interest, and they're not.
And is there some sort of unholy alliance between the Dental Association and the producers of the mercury that goes into amalgam?
Oh, sure. The American Dental Association, has a seal of acceptance that you see it on the toothpaste and everything when you buy in the drugstore. That's not a public service. I mean, it's a pay-to-play system. Go drive a few miles northeast to Sacramento. The largest, every interest group, as you would expect, has their own little building. You know, the trial lawyers, the realtors, the teachers, the medical association, et cetera, et cetera. The California Dental Association owns by far the tallest building in Sacramento, 16 stories tall. That's where they are. They own the second tallest building, 15 stories high. Everybody else is in a one- or two-story building. They have so much money, and it's not for member dues. It's their pay-to-play, the seal of acceptance system. The amalgam manufacturers slopped the ADA for years. The toothpaste makers a lot more so. And so... they've got so much more money. They have the largest PAC fund in Sacramento. They did some years. I don't track it every year. And they make sure, and what do they buy? Silence. What did the tobacco companies buy? Silence. All they want from legislators is don't talk about the mercury. And just like two generations of politicians never mentioned the word tobacco on the floor of Congress, nobody talks about it. And the CDA does well.
And, Charlie, this appears to have class implications, because it's probably people who are poorer, who get their dental care maybe from a clinic or elsewhere, but people who don't have financial freedom, don't have the options, or may not even consider the options, to get their fillings with a more expensive product.
You've hit it on the head. Let me go through that in two ways. First, the NAACP, testifying before Congress, called American the system of health care two-tiered dentistry: mercury for the poor, choice for the rich, and that's exactly what it is. But on another level, the taxpayers are getting ripped off by the dentists who use mercury. Amalgam appears to be the lowest priced material. It is the highest price. Why? Because of the mercury being dumped in the water, the cremation, those cremated, the mercury coming out of their amalgam, the burial, the sludge that's in the sludge. If you get dentists, as I say, dump it in the water, except for a few counties like San Francisco, city and county, which prohibit that. And so the taxpayers pick up the bill, or the parents pick it up in health care costs. So the ADA transfers, and the dentists who use mercury transfer the cost of amalgam to the taxpayers, rip them off, and have the lowest price and the easiest and quickest profits from amalgam. But in reality, an economist would say it's the highest price. So not only is the lower classes, the working people, the most likely to get the mercury fillings, and those in institutions, and I'll include Army and Navy, the pregnant sailors and the young men and women in the service are getting mercury, but the taxpayers are picking up the bill while the dental clinic machines walk out with the nice, easy profits.
Charlie, you've got a website at toxicteeth.org, and I'll put up a link to it in the show file that leads this podcast. In addition to these hearings in mid-December, what would you suggest listeners who are concerned or alarmed by these issues should do?
We've got an organization called Californians for Green Dentistry, and if people want to help us, they should write info@toxicteeth.org. We'd love to have volunteers in California. We're trying to create mercury-free zones in your state, the mercury-free communities, grassroots up. So we'd love to have volunteers. That's one thing people can do. Another is to write the Food and Drug Administration. They have, if you will, an open mic. They have people allowed to write them. And then on the day of the hearing, if people have asked in advance, they can testify. We're going to try to pack the room in Washington, D.C., Rockville, Maryland, nearby on December 14th and 15th. In between, though, people can write the FDA, or, as I say, they can volunteer and help us bring down mercury in dentistry community by community in the nation's most populous state.
Charles Brown, National Council for Consumers for Dental Choice. Charlie, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate you drawing attention to this important issue.
Peter B. Collins, nice to be on your show.
And before we go, a fresh commentary from comedian, satirist, political observer, Will Durst.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here, wondering if anybody remembers a few short years ago when attacking the president was a traitorous act that gave solace to the enemy. Well, not anymore. Beating on the president of the United States these days has become a cottage industry. You're even allowed to call him a terrorist because he refuses to answer the question, when did you stop being a Muslim? And the people who do think he's a Christian don't think he's the right kind of Christian. And as we all know, there are two kinds of Christians. Those who believe the same thing that you believe, and those doomed to spend all of eternity burning in the fires of hell. Bless their little hearts. I'm talking about the new poll that shows that one-fifth of the American public believes that President Obama is a Muslim, a larger percentage than when he was elected. And I know exactly why this is. They're idiots, stone-crazed loons with the jellied brains of someone who gets off on sticking a talk show immersion blender up their nose. On the other hand, the good news is these very same people do agree that he's black. Not just black, but right fist high in the sky while wearing shades and a bow tie black. Makes Spike Lee look like a Scottish guy. Another misconception, since we all know that Obama is only half black. And isn't that just like America? Yeah, we can elect an African-American president, but first, I don't know, why don't we try a half black guy? You know, like a starter Negro. A hybrid. Baby steps. Then we'll work our way up to Ving Rhames. Of course, you know who plays Barack in the movie? Tom Hanks. Just like Sara Lee, nobody doesn't like Tom Hanks. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Happy trails, everybody. Drop me an email and send me a picture of your big smile, will you? Peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.